You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils, you'll want to invite everyone over, from book club to the fantasy league, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils are infused with 2 times more natural essential oils versus regular Airwick Scented Oils for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Transform your space with scents like white sage and mahogany or lavender and water lily. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And here you go, the much anticipated Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling you from beautiful Seattle, Washington. You know, in these dog days of summer and during the pandemic, I have a lot of time to think, you know. Karl Marx, we all know his name. Famous guy, Karl Marx, you know, and so the, you know, kind of the communist socialist. Guidebook and Karl Marx, famous. But nobody talks about his sister Anya, who invented the starter pistol. Nobody ever talks about his sister Anya Marx. Thank you very much.
Oh wow, he went a long way around to get to that punchline, didn't he? But at least you know one thing about Duff. He will never let us down. He's always starting our weekend off with some kind of laugh for the last 3 years. Thanks to Duff. And if you're looking for more laughs, Winnipeggers episode 3 came out last night. This one is about near-death experiences. Dave almost drowns because of a girl. Ribo almost skis off the edge of the mountain because of a girl. And I almost get shot in a dark area of Mexico City because of a girl. Yeah. Near-death experiences because of a girl is what we should call it. New episodes of the Winnipeggers every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern on my official YouTube channel and Facebook page. And the Sinai special, I think it's going to happen tomorrow night. Fozzie has a show in North Dakota, but I'm going to figure out how to do a Saturday night special one way or another. Stay tuned to my Instagram and Twitter accounts for the exact time. But I'm going to go live on Facebook Live and YouTube Live if I can on Saturday night. So we'll be sharing more questions, telling stories, and of course the Saturday special sing-along tomorrow night, if possible. Stick with me, and I will give you all the news if I haven't already. But coming up today, two of the all-time greats in the business, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard, together on a podcast for the very first time. They've been reunited in AEW for the first time since working together as one of the greatest tag teams in the world in the 80s. And what a run they had. They're going to be talking about that. How they teamed up in the first place. What split them up and how they both ended up in AEW. So it's Arn and Tully together on a podcast for the first time ever. Coming up next on Talk is Jericho. Okay, so the last few weeks in AEW, we had FTR came in, and the thing I've always heard about them is they're tag team specialists, just like Tully and Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard Anderson. So I've been wanting to talk to both you guys for a long time, but I thought how cool it would be to talk together, one of the greatest pure tag teams of all time, Arn and Tully. And
one of the greatest?
The greatest. I had a little hiccup there. Sorry, buddy.
That's okay.
The greatest pure tag team. I guess I want to ask, because Arn, you were in the scene in WWE, and Tully, I don't know if you were watching or not. When you see FTR, do you see why people compare them to you guys?
I think it was an absolute effort on their part to pattern themselves after our style, but I also saw that they took the concept of whatever it may be, you know, suckering a guy in, making him chase you, roll back in, get his back turned to your opponent. A tag that he doesn't see, the guy steps in from behind, plows him. That psychology, but they put their tweak on it. And, you know, they're all hell of a lot. I don't know if you noticed, they're a hell of a lot more athletic than you and I are and were. But it's the same concept. They truly are they give you at the end of the day, they're a team that knows what their partner's doing at all times. Mm-hmm. That's what makes a great team, I think.
It almost goes back to an old school style of wrestling, because like you mentioned, the guys these days are so athletic. Like I remember back, I watched these matches with Jerry Lynn and go, remember they used to call us high flyers?
Yeah, buddy.
And the bar is just raised so much over the years. But when you see wrestling today, Tully, and tag team wrestling, do you see the holes in it and what you would do to kind of shore it up? Or are you one of the guys like myself that just goes and realizes that the business evolves?
Well, I think I've been gone for a longer period than either one of you guys. And so I come back and I look at stuff and I recognize holes that I would probably adjust if me and Arn were transformed back into this period, mm-hmm. and go, okay, this is what we got to do and blah, 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 blah. And it is, but you've also got to realize that it's never going back.
Right.
Just like our country's never going back or mm-hmm. the world's never going back. You can't go back and go back to the wrist lock,
mm-hmm. right?
And have riots.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like that with any sport. Like hockey has changed and football has changed, and it's just a different world now. But it's great to have both you guys in AEW, kind of helping and coaching and teaching and giving advice. Is this the first time you guys have worked in the same company for years, 10 years, 20 years?
Oh yeah, since 89.
Really. Wow, since your Brainbusters run, basically, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about how you guys became a team, and also, too, I have to say, of the original Four Horsemen, which, of course, is the greatest faction of all time. How did this all come together with you guys first aligning with each other?
You know, I don't remember at what focal point Tully and I became a team, other than when we kicked Ole out, who was ready to go home and watch his kid wrestle amateur. At the time, we were offended, both on a shoot and a work, because we were red hot. But he said, hey guys, you know, I didn't sign up for life. I want to go see my kid wrestle amateur at UTC Chattanooga. Now,
this was the original Four Horsemen with Flair, Ole, and
Tully,
you two guys.
JJ.
Oh, Jay. Okay, and
myself.
You. Yeah.
And, you know, and it just kind of came out of nowhere. And so we went, okay, we got a hell of a thing here, but, you know, we got to honor his wishes, because he was going one way or the other.
Yeah.
Period. And now, as a dad with a 23-year-old that has got to see my son in, you know, in the sports, high school sports and all that stuff, you know, he didn't make it in college, but I get it. Mm-hmm. I get it now. And once we kicked him out and put Luger in his place, there was a natural evolution to move Rick into Rick's spot as a world champion. Luger's the guy that we had to make into the heavy hitter just because of his look,
mm-hmm.
and that left me and Tully kind of as a team.
Yeah.
That's the way I remember it, and we just kind of fell into it, and it clicked from day one. And I've said before, I learned more about tag team wrestling with this guy than anybody that I had as a partner, and I had some great partners mm-hmm. over the years, but he just knows how to get heat. And in the course of, you know, sucking a guy in and you know, and all those things we used to do, mostly would get a guy to blow a stack, and while he's pounding the piss out of this guy, he forgot about the one that's going to do the damage, which is the one fixing to kick him in the back of the head.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of taught me that psychology, and we just clicked. It got to a point, Chris, and you may have been it this way with some partners in the past, I could just look at him. I could have him in headlock, and I could just look at him, and he knew what I wanted. I may take it as far as just to tap myself on the leg, shoot him off. If I dropped down when he hit those ropes, he knew, catch him in the back. And it got to be automatic, and that's when it really got fun.
Yeah, it was, and it was fun. And it was one of the things when we went up to the WWE, was things wanted to be a little more planned out,
mm-hmm.
which didn't really float real well.
Right. You know, it's that way to this day.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. I said, do what? When? How? What?
You're talking about having calling more spots in the back rather than just feeling it in the ring.
Exactly.
Right.
And which is where we were at. Mm-hmm. And it was fun to go to work. Mm-hmm. Working with this guy every stinking night. I mean, it was you had fun in the ring, and you knew that 16,000 people or however many were there got their money's worth watching us, and that was satisfying. Mm-hmm. And that was what we were paid to do, was entertain people and bring them back the next time. And it was really that period of from 85 to 89 was it was like a flash. Mm-hmm. But it was the best time that I've ever had in my life. And you know, to be able to come back and hopefully give a bunch of knowledge that can still be applied, maybe tweaked a little bit, but applied, is very exciting to me. Mm-hmm. Because worked and worked and worked, and you guys are in flow, but to be away for 20 years, yeah, 25 years, 30 years, yeah, and come back, this is, you know, a different atmosphere for me. And a lot still feels the same, but still there's new stuff going on. But it's exciting to be part of the AEW family. And
you know, when you mentioned Arn about the Four Horsemen, like when I started the Inner Circle, it was basically, I think most factions kind of go off the Four Horsemen model. I got Jake the Killer, he's the Luger type. I got the great tag team of Santana Ortiz. I got Sammy, myself. And how did the Four Horsemen start in the first place? Like, was this something that Flair started, or Ole as the booker? Or
you wouldn't believe me if I told you.
Please
this
do.
This is the God's truth, and it is just, when I say this, you're gonna be waiting for the story part, and there is not a story part. In those days, we had like a a 3:38 interview slot. And
3 minutes and 38 seconds?
3 minutes, 38 seconds. And it just so happened, I mean, we had started to be in, you know, intermingling and all that stuff. And, you know, different combinations of guys were having tags and stuff. But we happened to all be out on one promo one day. And we had to get it all done in 3:38, and there were three matches.
Can I interject?
Yep.
Because we were in an eight-man tag match. Mm. It was the Andersons and Flair the Cousin, and just because I was wrestling a booker, I got slid in.
Okay. So there we stood, four of us, and we started, guys, they started into their promos, whoever went ahead of me, I don't remember. And I was just looking and counting heads, and I don't know how or why, but the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and the biblical story of what they do, and when it's time, it popped in my head. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a religious guy, certainly believe in God, but I'm not a Bible thumper. That was in my prefrontal lobe. It just popped in there, like promos, right?
Right.
We don't know how stuff pops in there. Yeah. We just roll with it. And I went into this deal. Hey, you're dealing with, you know, you're looking at the Four Horsemen, and never has so much damage been done to so many by so few.
Wow.
And literally, that's how it happened.
And it literally was, and I just did that.
Put up the four fingers.
Just did that. And the promo subsided, and Tony Giovanni looked like somebody had seen a ghost. He said, Arn, you just named you guys. That's great. And we went, okay. And whenever we got to that town and we went out there, I did it, he did it, everybody kind of did it, Rick did it, and it was done.
And it became a thing.
Yeah.
It literally just ran. And we didn't even talk about it. They didn't say, what the hell is that Four Horsemen thing you're talking about?
A month or 2 months afterwards, we were in the Greensboro Coliseum, and in the tunnel we were watching, and Jim Crockett was there, and he said, Tully, this four horsemen thing is getting over, isn't it? And I gave him, I was kind of sarcastic back in those days. I gave,
really?
I gave him some who shot John look and just kind of walked back in the dressing room.
But you never know what's going to catch on. It's like, oh, that's like the Austin 316, just off the top of his head, and suddenly people get into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we just recognized it. It's not like we really sat down and went, okay, hey, wait a minute, what just happened here? Let's dissect this.
Yeah.
Just run with it.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
At this point in time, you mentioned 85. Was that kind of the beginning of the peak of Crockett at the time?
No, I would say the peak would be 87 was the hottest year.
Gotcha.
And then when we moved into 88, it was still really good right up until the point that we left, which was, I think, September of 88.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. September.
Yeah. Started to go down then?
And we did.
No, it started to go down when we left.
Right, gotcha.
Because they tried to resurrect the horsemen because it was the deal, but you can't resurrect. You can't have a Shelby GT without the engine, and you're looking at the engine.
That's great.
Well, here's the thing: we were the part that a lot of people miss that don't even know about is right before we left. We had the meeting where we found out we're not going to get our money. We had just shot. We're about 3 weeks into an angle with the Midnight Express, who were heels also. Mm-hmm. And you know how Cornette is. He's good on that stick. And we had had some banter back and forth. In those days, you did not have heels fighting heels. It was heels against baby faces. Mm-hmm. You never had that. And we shot that angle with those guys, and the thing flared up. I mean, it blew up. The Charlotte Coliseum was brand new at that time. And it was Luger and Flair on top, which they had already seen. And it was us and the Midnight Express. We did like, I want to say 13,000 fans for Charlotte and for a heel match.
Mm-hmm.
And then before we went any further with it, we put our notice in. And it fueled business. Tommy Rogers and what was his partner?
Bobby Fulton. Fantastics.
After we left, well, Crockett didn't change the advertising. He left that match intact.
Oh, I see.
Those guys walked in the door on some $8,000 weeks. They told me so.
Mm-hmm.
They took all of our bookings and they walked in the door and the business. I mean, ultimately, I think that hurt Crockett a lot for the audience.
False advertising.
They got there, false advertising. That's by no shape or form the same match that they paid for.
Mm-hmm.
But, it, you know, like anything
especially
else.
A month later, we popped up on WWE's wrestling show.
Yeah.
And they're still advertising you in Crockett's company.
Yeah.
But that's how it was back in those days. You got paid on the house.
Yep.
You got paid on the gate.
Absolutely.
So if the gate was the shits, you didn't get anything. So when you guys, who were some of your hottest teams that you worked against for, you know, crowd-wise and payoff-wise?
I don't think anything was higher. I never felt anything like we broke Dusty's leg.
Tell us about that angle. That's one of the classics.
It was incredible. Yeah. It was the deal in the cage, right?
Yeah, in Atlanta.
It was a cage match. It was an end around. It was like the Russians were wrestling Flair. Wait a minute. Let me get this right. Who are the Russians wrestling?
I don't remember.
Nikita Koloff and
Ivan Koloff.
It was either him or Darso or something. Right. Anyway, how it evolved down was we hit, as the Russians were leaving, I think it was Dusty and somebody, wasn't it?
No, I think Dusty came in the ring. He wasn't in the match. He came in to save
somebody. Let me just skip ahead to get to the meat of it.
We'll get the details from people online. I'll know the match. If Cody was there, he'd know it all.
Really good job, Brandon.
If Tony Khan was there, he'd know everything.
Holy smokes.
I'm the same way. You can't remember anything that happened. Just remember the actual angle. So Dusty's in there some reason.
The actual angle is we got the door locked and Flair. Dusty had came down to save Flair and then Flair turned on him.
Gotcha.
Some version of that.
Yeah.
And Ole and I were in there. Tully was in there. And we just put the wood to Dusty. And we had a riot. Mm. They opened the door for us to get out. And as we started to step out, about 15 people across and about 10 deep just pushed forward and shut the door back on us. Like, scared me to death.
Wow.
Yeah.
Guys started coming down, baby faces, and I mean Ricky and Robert, some value baby faces, and we're knocking them off the cage. They're not getting it done either, and nobody's doing anything about this, and we're continuing to stomp Dusty's leg, stomp his leg, stomp his leg. And, brother, they finally got the door open again, and it took us about 20 minutes to get to the dressing room. They beat the ever-loving piss out of us, they being the audience.
Right.
Man, we all had splits in our head, and I mean, it was like they were throwing shit. They beat us up. Had it not been for 10 Atlanta police officers with their nightsticks beating them back, they saved our lives that night.
That's
no doubt they saved our lives. Anybody was there that night, they're a fan. If you could find fans that were there that night, they'll tell you. It was a full-blown riot. You
should have just stayed in the cage.
I was happy with that.
But see, just think about that, and people don't understand because I had a couple riots, nothing like this, but that's completely gone now, that side of the coin. But in this day, people still were like, if you're going to beat up Dusty Rhodes, they're feeling it, and they're legitimately angry and pissed off at you guys. It's real.
And we'd already done the arm thing, hadn't we?
Yeah, we had already broke his arm where we tied him to a truck. Mm-hmm. This was deeper in, you know, where the company needed a shot in the ass, which leads us to your original question. He was out a while, and we just talked about it and laughed about it, and we built that up. It flamed up about Dusty, and he just let us get heat for weeks and weeks and months. And we came back from that injury. It was him and the Road Warriors against Rick, Tully, and I in Philadelphia. And, buddy, the Road Warriors music hit. We hadn't seen Dusty in months. That door flew open, and they had painted him up, too.
Man, goosebumps. Aaron's got goosebumps.
When they're coming down that aisle, those people in Philly were, as you can imagine, you know, that's a bloodthirsty
They're ready to bunch. Riot as it is, just in general principles.
They knew what was coming, and boy, were they right.
Oh, wow.
Those guys slid in that ring, and, man, they were so high, we didn't want to let it dip at all. We just slid right back in, and the fight started wide open, six way, and it was pretty much a six way for the next 10 or 12 minutes with them just tagging in and us feeding them. I don't remember exactly, but I don't think we even got any heat in the match.
Oh no,
they beat us up for 12 minutes and beat us right in the middle,
which is what they should have
called for.
That's right.
Yeah,
it's exactly the right thing to do. We slow them down just enough to tag out, and the guy coming in would go right into a lion's mouth roaring.
Beautiful. That's the sign of a great heel. You understand. Like, we adapted that kind of principle for the Stadium Stampede, where each member of the Elite put a nail in the casket of each guy in the inner circle. Everybody's beat. All five of us are down. We're done. And then the next time you come out and do something dastardly, get your heat all back, and doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But when it's time to put the baby faces over, you got to put them over big time.
Strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't pay to see us beat them up.
Right.
Or they didn't.
Oh,
they pay to see them kick our ass.
Yes. Mm. And we always gave our whole philosophy was get enough heat to get beat up for the next 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Go back and get enough heat to get beat up for five more minutes.
It's true. So how was it working with the Road Warriors? Because this is 85 Road Warriors. They're jacked to the gills, 280, 300 pounds. And I've never worked with either of them, but there's certain guys over the years that it's a lethal combination of big and strong and completely the shits. Did the Road Warriors fall into that category, or do they have a little bit Because when they're big and strong in the shits, you're in trouble. You got no hope.
They got better than that.
But. Okay, good.
Well, Chris, they after about two matches of us saying we would like to do this and this and this and this and this for you, and then going out and putting it where it goes and doing it, and again, it was just them pressing us.
Mm-hmm.
Big tackle, through the ropes, all the big stuff that they could do. We were plugging it in for them, so then they trusted us. They got good enough and polished enough that they could do all those big moves, and with the transitions and us just feeding them,
yeah,
that it was, I would say, better than passable. And when they left the ring, which was the key, we hadn't taken any of the edge off of the way they looked, because it's hard to follow a look like that and make their physicality.
Sure.
Be as good as the look.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those shoulder pads, and they were both huge. Hawk with those big traps. Joe was thick as hell.
330.
I mean, he was big. I mean, 600 bencher, all that stuff. It was all, and you know, painted up with the bright colors.
Right.
It was a spectacle. And if you didn't make them the Road Warriors, then you failed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was our challenge at night, to go make them the Road Warriors, just like Dusty. Yeah, we could have grounded Dusty and kept him down and tagged in and out and beat the piss out of him. You think that's what the audience wants to see the American Dream doing? Get him down, get him bleeding, and buddy, when this starts, shit's on.
Mm-hmm. The elbows come.
Yeah. And you knew what you had when he was on his feet jabbing, even if Ole used to hate it. When we would all feed Dusty, and he's jabbing
with a
and
passion.
We're all in a row with our heads, you know, popping back. And boom.
The rigmarole
and
shitty punch.
All down.
Oh yeah, but he hit all four of us.
Like the Three Stooges.
Oh yeah. We'd be up there taking the elbow, and all four of us are Bob. Like
one punch took all you down.
Yeah, and he refused. He been only a couple of nights. He refused to come in and feed that. He said, "That's the worst thing I've ever seen." So, okay, you can be involved in this, or you can stand over there looking like a jackoff. Buddy, I'm having fun, because if you heard what I heard, you might not buy it, but all them did.
Was Dusty Booker at this point in time?
Yes.
How was he as a booker? Because you always hear different stories about it.
I thought just being in the ring with Dusty Rhodes was, to me, if he walked in this room right now, I'd be as starstruck as the first time I met him. I think that he had a lot of great ideas. And I think the biggest thing, if you tell the truth, besides having some of the ideas he brought up from Florida, from Eddie Graham, is he had the best crew ever assembled in the history of the business.
That's a great point.
Yes.
85, 86, 87 NWA, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
That era?
When you got Brad Armstrong in the first match.
Great point.
Tim Horner.
Yeah.
And it grew, though. I mean, it was, we got all those guys over periods.
Yeah. I mean, you got Buddy Landale, you know, who his demise was unfortunate, which he brought on himself. He killed his own career.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy was red hot when he came to Carolinas. He jumped right on the Flair thing. And Buddy, Flair was God in the Carolinas at that time. You know, you got the Midnight Express and the Rock and Roll Express, and all these guys came in about a month period. Mm-hmm. Just a flood of talent.
Yeah.
It was a very tag team friendly company, right?
Jimmy Garvin.
Yes. Yeah.
You know?
It was, you weren't quite there yet when Dusty first took over the book in end of 84. And you came in
March of 85.
March of 85. So I was there and had a short meeting with Dusty, and he said, "What do we got to do to get this thing going? You've been a booker." And I said,
"Well, you had booked in Texas."
Yeah. And I said, you got to put the best against the best. That's the best rule. He said, "Well, Wahoo is wanting to work with me and blah, 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 blah," because Wahoo had switched heel a little bit with me. And the first sellout since I had been back there in 84 was me and Wahoo against Flair and Mulligan in an Indian rope strap
match. Or whatever,
yeah. And so I told Dusty, and this is the only time I've ever done anything career self-motivating. I said, well, Dusty, I said, I'd put Wahoo against Flair and let him beat the shit out of each other. And I said, I'd put me against you because I'll make you look great. And that's what happened. And that started my relationship with Dusty, which was a very good one. And it just, when Arn came in to be part of the Andersons and Ole came in, and then the whole thing at the end of 80, that was at the end of 85, when the Horseman thing happened. And I was the odd man out because I wasn't part of the Anderson family. But I was working with Dusty and that eight-man tag match. Hallelujah, I'm in it.
That's what wrestling's all about is the timing, right?
Well, yeah, you just said it. Timing. Timing is everything.
Yeah, exactly.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Let's talk a little bit about Flair, just because this is Flair at his peak as well as a draw and as a worker. The four of you guys, even Luger at the time, probably just learned so much from you guys. But what was it like watching Flair at his peak, basically, and being his partners during that time?
The thing that amazed me, which I was a rookie, which in those days you said you were a rookie until about 4 years. And in those days that was over 1,200 matches because you were working over 300 days. So right. That's a lot of matches.
Right.
You know, there are guys that have 10-year careers that don't have that many matches. But I think the thing that amazed me, and I learned something from all these guys, but just how over he was, no matter what he did in that ring, he was a babyface. It's crazy, Chris. He was a babyface in the Carolinas, but he was a heel everywhere else. And we would do Atlanta TV, which went everywhere, but it was crazy. No matter who he worked with, he was a babyface in the Carolinas. Move him.
The fans wanted him to be a babyface anyway. If it wasn't for me and him keeping him pulled on the dark side.
More him.
Yeah. Oh, more Tully.
Was the one that kept the heat on us. I would find nights where they would be cheering for me for no apparent reason, but booing the piss out of him. It was really just nuts. And I think that was more of that, okay, I'm one of the Andersons, Ole and I were partners, I'm home team, because they cut their teeth in the Carolinas. Wrestling fans and you know, true wrestling fans are really loyal. Stuff that gets over, it's still over with them.
Oh, yeah. 35, 40 years later.
When they were teenagers, I can't tell you, how many times do you have people come up to you, because you're an old-timer now, you old fart.
Not as old as you.
Thanks for no joke.
Thank you. That was a people, comeback.
Come on, feed me, Arn. No, but you're right. And what you're saying, too, is the reason why people might cheer the Four Horsemen is because of the Four Horsemen sign. Fans love to be included with that stuff. So I could see guys like you and me, all three of us, if we were wrestling fans in the crowd, and these four cool-looking guys who got their shit together holding up the sign, I'd be all in. You know what I mean? Sure. I can see why it might be one of the first examples of being a heel that people think is cool.
Well, and they started to figure out, hey, the good guys aren't really knocking those guys down.
Yeah.
Those are the guys that are creating all the excitement.
Right.
And I knew as a fan, when that happened for me, whatever age that was, 15 or whatever, Dick Slater and Bob Orton were the team that did it, and there were heels on Atlanta TV. Gary Hart was their manager. And it's like they were out there having a match with, I don't even remember who it was, but I went, wait a minute. Those are the guys doing all the stuff. These guys aren't really knocking them down. They're just, and I didn't know the terminology for it, but they're feeding them.
Right.
And in a great way, and making them look like Godzilla.
Whenever those guys have a match, it's always good. Four Horsemen.
Yes.
I used to think that about, you know, certain teams. Like, whenever they're in the ring, it's always good.
Yeah.
How can that be? Why does every time Randy Savage is in the ring with Ricky Steamboat, obviously, or Honky Tonk Man, or guys that are further down in the work rate, why is it always good? And then you start figuring, oh, because he's the one who's running the show. Right.
And they figure out you're dedicated to making it like that for them mm-hmm. every time. Mm-hmm. Every time they buy a ticket, they know no matter what they see all night, in any combination, the four of us, we're going to go out and make it good for them, mm-hmm. for the audience. That's your job.
And for the guys.
And for the baby faces. Because right. they're the ones that draw money.
Right.
Heels don't draw money. Mm-hmm. Baby faces do. Mm-hmm. But you got to create a scenario to why you want them.
Well, it's like a movie.
To kick your ass.
You know, if the action hero is getting the shit kicked out of him in the movie, and then at the end he makes his big comeback and wins, that's what you want to see. But there has to be some shit getting kicked out of you to make the people interested.
God almighty, huh? For sure.
Speaking of that, what was it like Ricky and Robert? Ricky Morton's one of the best sellers ever. It must have been a pleasure to work with those guys.
For any team of that era, there was no better scenario than to see your name written down beside those guys.
Hmm.
For a heel team, oh my God.
We did an hour Broadway in a cage. In Greensboro. Yeah.
In a cage too, nowhere to go.
And they were the champions.
Wow.
Which, you know what, you know, you're a psychologist, you know what had to happen in the match, right?
Yeah, of course.
We beat them up for an hour.
Yeah, that's right. Especially if you're not going over.
They were going over clean, and they were the champions, and they were great about it. But we beat them up for, I'd say, 50 minutes. And, man, once you got Ricky Morton bleeding with that white hair, he looked 12 years old.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I can't tell you how many times Tully would shoot him out. I'd drop down to the floor to run him into the rail or something. And as I bent over to get him, whack, some little old lady would break her walking stick across my back. And I sold the piss out of it.
It hurts.
Yeah, it stung a little bit. And I say a lot. It must have happened 8 to 10 times, mm-hmm. which is a lot mm-hmm. for something that odd. I mean, no regard for getting arrested. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. No. And that was before barricades. I mean, that was the piece of rope.
A string.
Yeah, you had a one strand of rope separating you from the audience.
Did you guys get attacked by the crowd quite a bit? You mentioned the riot, and this was a lot of times that happened.
No.
People, once again, still believing that it's real, that you're going to kick their ass if they touch you.
We still, Ole got cut real bad, but that was years before any of this stuff happened.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a lot of people jump on us. I guess that's why, you know, we would make sure that we would get out of there. Whatever happened, if it was a heat finish, we would get out of there quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it was something different. But you always wanted to leave the baby faces up at the end of the night anyway.
No matter what.
So as long as they were in the ring capturing a lot of the attention, you could make your way pretty quickly and get out of there if you're smart.
Full of runner, around, yeah.
You're going to get bombed with shit, especially because the show's over. Throw me out.
Yeah.
Show's over, right?
That's right.
And depending on the town, too. I know Cleveland, we wrestled downtown Cleveland and hadn't been there in forever. And, God, they started bombing you with batteries from the balcony.
Yeah. That's the night that the half-pint liquor bottle came from the upper deck. And I just caught something coming out of the corner of my eye, and it hit on the mat and just skipped across the mat right back out of the ring. If that hit you in the head.
Oh, yeah, you'd be done.
I mean, plausibly it'd kill you.
I got hit with a D battery in San Francisco. One big giant.
That's a big one.
Like, who the fuck is bringing D batteries to the show? To throw them, or did you have some kind of a boom box with you or something?
I think you might have had some heat way before that day ever got there.
Yeah.
That was a planned attack on you, young man.
Let's talk a little bit about the traveling. You hear about the Four Horsemen and Crockett's jet and the planes and all that stuff. You guys were living high on the horse.
Better believe it. Mm-hmm. It's there's no other way to put it. It's he should have bought one plane. The Gulfstream, which could carry the whole crew,
mm-hmm.
but was slower, but it was big and wide. You get up and walk around, had a real big bathroom on it.
16 people, wasn't it?
Full of beer. It held 16 people and had captain's chairs. I mean, mm-hmm. it was designed to haul an athletic team.
Right.
The other one was the I'm Elvis plane. It was a 10-seat Falcon. And brother, when that thing took off, it went straight up. I mean, it was a jet.
Mm-hmm.
And if they hadn't have bought that plane, I think they would have had a much better profit at the end of the year, that thing was like $4,500 an hour to operate in those or days. More. You know, and which is pretty stout. But hey, to pull out to Butler Aviation, and we all bought Mercedes. You know, we thought we were going to be
live forever.
You know, we were Led Zeppelin, brother. Why not? And we bought it the same day. We all went, showed up. And we bought four. He bought two.
He bought two Mercedes.
See, crazy. His and her.
Yeah, bought his wife one, bought himself. But he had to show us up. So you'd pull out to Butler Aviation. They would let you pull. This is how times have changed. They let you pull right out to the plane. Mm-hmm. Pilots would get your bags out of the car. Your wife would usually bring you or something. Mm-hmm. Take your bags, you'd walk up the steps, sit down, she'd pull back through the gate, drop you off, leave, and fly on those private planes. We'd land. Rick wanted limos, he got limos. Limos waiting at the steps, walk down the steps, get in the limousine, go straight to the Marriott, check in. Now, depending on what time of day it was, you might go to the gym, you might have already been that morning, you know. And we go have the show, go right back to the Marriott, or sometimes go back to the plane and go to the next town.
Mm-hmm. Or go back home.
Or go, even better, go back home.
If it was west of the if it was east of the Mississippi, we'd go back to Charlotte.
It would be the same flight crew, same pilots?
Same pilots.
We had four full-time pilots.
Wow. Did they hang out with you guys sometimes, or did you have to stay away from them?
They had a few drinks until we finally figured out, you know, they would come there and I'd look over and it's like, okay, it's 3 a.m. We're leaving at 11. He's laying down in the floor over there. The man that is going to, Freddie Floyd, that is going to pilot us in less than 8 hours is laying in the floor asleep. Many times, not to discredit Freddie, who was a hell of a pilot, but many times we would thump up those steps and look up. The first thing we would do is look up there in that captain's chair, and Freddie would be sweating his ass off, hungover as he could be. We'd look at Pat Jordan, who was the co-pilot, and it would be just a little suggestion, but y'all might want to swap seats.
Oh, man. And flying, did you ever have any high spots flying on the plane? You know,
there was one.
The fog one.
The one in Canada. It was on the Gulf Stream where something, oil got on something and the cabin filled
yeah.
up.
Yeah, filled up with smoke. Oh,
the cabin filled up with smoke. That was pretty scary. That was when the guy booked the tour that we never got paid for.
Yeah.
The one of your fellow Canadians that played for... he's a legend up there. What's his name? He played football for
Angelo Mosca.
Angelo Mosca.
Yeah.
He ran a tour, 3 or 4 day tour.
Yeah.
Up there, and the Gulf Stream filled up with smoke. That was a little scary.
Yeah, that was. And then we were coming back. I think it was from St. Louis, flying back to Charlotte, and it was fog, almost. And I said, Freddie, I said, because I rode on the jump seat a lot. Mm-hmm. And up with the pilots. And so I'm going, Freddie, I can't see the ground. and I was up there enough to where I knew which
button or
which dial yeah. had your altitude and that kind of stuff. And we broke through the clouds, could see the ground, and hit the ground.
Wow.
And I went, holy crap. And that was y'all didn't really weren't in on that one quite as much.
I'm fine with not being in.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
You mentioned the reason why you guys left Crockett, but going to WWE, had you spoken to Vince before you gave your notice with Crockett?
Yes.
So you guys come in, and most guys that go to the WWE have some kind of a gimmick change, name change, whatever it may be. You guys didn't. You just gave me the name of the Brainbusters. How did that come about?
we lucked out, I think. They asked us for new names. Obviously, they were pretty clear that we don't see the Four Horsemen bullshit.
Right.
Which you couldn't avoid for a short period of time.
Vince hated it because he never created it, so he didn't want to have anything to do with
it. Oh, and they when the fans would put it up, they sent guys out in the audience to pull them all down.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. The first night.
We didn't do this, but they were all doing it, and it was pretty uncomfortable. And after about 2 or 3 weeks of not giving it back to them, the audience got pretty much pissed and just quit doing it. It was like,
right.
It was like, hey, man, you know, we watch both shows, you know.
This, you can't do that.
We like this. Yeah, give us something back.
You can't give us the four fingers here. Yeah. So when you came in to talk to Vince, what kind of a meeting did you have to create whatever gimmick or whatever it was going to be?
Well, Barry Darso was already there. He was half a demolition, and he was having a good run, and they liked him up there. He had sent word to me a couple of times, hey, Vince has kind of said, you know, if you guys aren't ever not happy, come on up. Well, we were happy till then because things were going well. And if we would have gotten paid like we should have got paid for the pay-per-view that they told us we were going to make, when your boss walks in and says, listen, we got a pay-per-view coming up. I want to pay you guys X amount of dollars. Don't you think that's going to happen?
Sure.
Or why would you ever do that beforehand? Yeah. Just you have the show, you get paid what you get paid, and you go from there. So that was the reason we left.
Which pay-per-view was that? What match was it? Do you recall?
It was
Our first pay-per-view in Baltimore.
It was the first one in was it the Meadowlands, wasn't it? Was it the Meadowlands?
No, the first pay-per-view was in Baltimore.
It was in Baltimore.
And we wrestled on the opener.
But the opener was Sting and somebody, wasn't
Nikita.
It? Sting
it's
and
a fairly
Nikita.
Big match then.
So we tore the joint down on purpose. It was one of those follow that gimmicks, which was just them beating us up again for 20 minutes. But, you know, and then we got our checks, and mine was way less than half. It was less than half of what he talked about. And I got a hold of Barry and I said, hey, they're not going to make this thing right for us. And then they started beating us real quick on TV for no apparent reason with some good guys. But still, I mean.
You can see the writing on the wall.
We went out one night and had a 15-minute match, I think, with the Midnight's Dark. I think it was Houston or something. Tore the joint down. This was right before we quit. Well, 30 minutes later, they had me go right back out with Steve Williams and put him over in 3 minutes, which Steve Williams could have beat me in 30 seconds.
Right.
It's not the point.
It's the principle.
It just buried us and the Midnight Express, you know, one of those deals. So I talked to Barry. I said, you know, tell Vince we're interested. And like pretty soon, he said, let me get back to you. Call me back in 30 minutes. He said, where are you guys at? Well, we were going to Philly. That was going to be the next show. He said, Vince is going to have, he says, tell me where you're going to fly out of, where are you going to be, you're close to an airport and all that. So we came in on the private plane, Philly. Next morning we got up early, flew to New York, had a limo pick us up, took us to his house. We met with him out by the pool.
Wow.
Which I thought, man, what the hell have we been waiting on?
Yeah.
And you know how he is.
Yep.
He had his pep talk, and we left there about 4 feet off the ground. Felt like floating. And he made some promises, you know, that would come into play later in our career for the reason it never panned out and reason we left.
But so I guess my point is, why did he not want to give you guys some kind of different names and different gimmick?
Back to the original deal.
Yeah.
Well, he asked. Yeah. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
He asked for, you know, can you, and we couldn't come up with anything. You know, he and I tried to, and, you know, we were just.
I think Heenan came up with Brainbusters.
Well, they said, we're going to put you with Bobby Heenan.
Oh, wow.
And I think Bobby said, hell, let's call him the Brainbusters, which gave us immediate credibility.
Yeah.
Immediate credibility. And Chris, our costuming was just normal, you know, just red and white boots, red tights, whatever the deal. It was nothing special, and he didn't mess with that. He just let us
gave us a different logo thing that we had on the back of the jackets that were.
And he said about 6 months into it, one day we're talking to him, he just went, you know, you guys give credibility to my company, to my business.
Yeah.
I think he said you lend credibility to my business. And I think looking back on it, that's why he didn't dress us up.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing you do with Harley. He was just Harley Race. He became the King Harley Race, but it was Harley Race.
Yeah.
He didn't
yeah.
come in as, you know, Drake the Ice Cream Man or something like that.
You can't overcome something, you know, when it's that firmly embedded. Right.
It was fun because back in those days, there was no internet or, you know, any way to find anything out. All you had was the, you know, the Apter mags. And I never really got to see NWA growing up in Winnipeg, but I read the magazine, so I had seen, you know, Arn and Tully. But when you guys came in WWF, it was like, oh my gosh, it was exciting because they're here now. They're called the Brainbusters. That's great. You know, it was yeah. kind of cool to see the jumping back and forth back in those days. It was exciting.
Yeah, there was a such thing as a surprise.
Yeah,
and you could watch Brett and the Anvil beat us up.
And they did.
Is that who you got put with first?
No, SummerSlam. It was a big match for us because we had the titles,
mm-hmm.
and we were coming off of the screw job with Demolition and being with the Heenan family and all that. That was a big match, and they gave us some time, and they actually had us go over, which was in those days was. Pretty big deal because for some reason it was a non-title match,
mm-hmm.
which I'm thinking, and I think Brett, you know, felt the same way that they should go over. I didn't care one way or the other. I just wanted to.
If it's a non-title match, the babyfaces win to lead to a title match.
Right.
Right.
You know, so which made sense to me, and I was fine with anything, just getting to work with those guys because that's the only time we worked with them.
Once?
Just that one time, right?
No, we worked that whole Canadian tour.
We did
the pay-per-view we did, but then we did a Canadian tour because I can remember in Maple Leaf Garden,
mm-hmm.
The Anvil was brutal.
brutally beating you up? Or,
yeah. Why didn't you do something about it?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, that's another 300-pound lunatic, right?
So maybe there's a reason I can't remember that. I blocked it out.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
What were some of the biggest differences that you guys can remember between, you know, Crockett and Vince's company?
Ring size,
interesting.
Crockett's ring was smaller, and that ring really felt big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just things like reverse a turnbuckle, there were more steps involved.
Mm.
And when you first do it, the first night, you're starting to turn, and you're still about 4 or 5 feet out.
Timing's way off.
Yeah. And you figured out pretty soon, okay, that makes a difference in the steps because they were just automatic in your head,
mm-hmm.
you know, and rings were hard.
Really?
And funny story, like our first house show loop, we worked with Jimmy Powers and Roma, and we went out and we just did what we always did. We had a match mm-hmm. with them. Well, we came back through the curtain, there was Barry Darso right here. Come with me. He pulled me aside. He said, what the hell was all that bullshit? What are you guys out there bouncing around for those guys for? They're underneath guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I was kind of shocked because mm-hmm. he was pissed. He said, you know, we don't do that up here. You better, you know, you need to check with me on this stuff. Well, the thing was, the ring was so hard, we made everybody look bad.
Right.
We're bouncing around out there, and that was part of the reason, the unsaid reason, I bet you, if you could get guys from that era to tell you the truth, the reason everybody was into the walking, the talking, and the character stuff is because they didn't have to take bumps.
Mm.
Because that ring hurt.
Wow.
It was big difference in that one in Crockett's ring.
You're just shrugging your shoulders, Tony.
We didn't take very many press slams.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that the same thing happened to me. My first match in WCW was against Mr. JL, Jerry Lynn.
Yep.
Same thing that you guys just said. Went and had a match and came back afterward. It was Terry Taylor. It was like, what's wrong with you? That was the shits. I was like, why? You gave him way too much. I didn't know. No one told me anything. I just did the match that I always do, is just have a try and have the best match you can. But that's something you learn as you progress up the ladder.
Yeah. You know? Well, hey, we did. And but then as soon as we got in with the Rockers.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
That shit went out the window again, because we're flying all over the place for those guys. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We saw right away, these two are really good. Mm. And if we don't take advantage of this, we're fools. Mm-hmm. And we catered entirely to their style and did all their stuff. A lot of guys up there, because it was still the big guy era, which I hated. You know, you weren't going to have Demolition flying around for those guys. You weren't going to have the Powers of Pain flying around for those guys. You know, all the monsters, probably the Hearts, weren't going to fly around. Not Anvil wasn't going to fly around for those guys. So we wanted to get the very best we could out of them. And
let's talk about, because I haven't really spoken to anybody that really worked with the Rockers, obviously with Sean at length, but never talking about them as a team. So what was their magic as a team, and why did you like working with them so much?
Oh, they were much like Robert and Ricky. You know, they could both sell, both have comebacks, they both had fire, they were both handsome, and the, you know, beautiful baby faces are just fun to beat up. You know,
there's the headline for the show.
You should know that.
I used to be one.
Yes.
But the same with you, Arn, just their athletic ability, and because they were kind of pioneers at that time.
They were. If you go back and look at their stuff, which for today's world is, it doesn't, you don't go, okay, well, that was so much better than this, because today I don't know how these kids even think of what stuff they do. But in those days, I mean, just like Shawn Michaels reverse him towards the turnbuckle, he would just run right up the turnbuckle and turn a flip in the air and land behind you. He wouldn't touch nothing. You know, Jannetty just did little quirky things, like he'd come off the ropes, you go to hip toss him, he would just spin around on your arm and land on his feet right there. It was just different than anything not only had we seen, the audience hadn't seen it. And I don't think a lot of the teams wanted to let those guys do what they were capable of, because it was such a competitive deal back then. Everybody was fighting to get a notch above the other guys, you know, on that pecking order. And when we figured out what all they could do and they opened up to us, man, we weren't going to waste that.
Yeah. The thing that created our success was making baby faces. And that was what we tried to do there. And I think we did, even with Demolition and some of the other ones. You know, we just went out and kind of, we had to adapt a little bit because of what they could do. But it was still enough heat to give comebacks. And
that's the secret, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because there was such a, like you mentioned, such a size difference when you're talking about WWE, because everybody was just a monster and a giant. And you guys aren't monsters and giants, but you still fit in with all those teams because you could work to make everybody look good. That's a, you know, a secret.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, you know, Barry Darso and I were good friends and stuff, but it's like we would do a deal where Barry would hit the ropes by our corner, totally drive a knee in his back, I'd be legal. And as he sold out a couple steps, he'd let me vertical suplex him. And I'd stand him up and hold him. Nobody had done that with them, those guys. Just that one thing, boom, even though he kicked out and kicked out strong, that one thing the audience had never seen them do made me. I didn't have to do much else from an offensive point.
Right,
because no one had ever done it to them. You know, they were their road warriors. They steamrolled everybody, and they were dominant during matches. You know, Bulldogs and the Bulldog and Davey Boy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
British Bulldog.
Dynamite,
Great team. Great team. But they sold, those guys sold for Demolition like Demolition was the Road Warriors. Everybody did. Everybody did. It took five of us and a giant and a chair to take the titles off of them. If you go back and watch the match.
Yeah, Andre gave you guys a chair. To...
Yes.
How was he to be around at that point in time, Andre?
If he liked you, he was a very, very nice man. If he didn't, you better just quit the business. I mean, he came in the room every night. He had his bottles of wine. He played cards till time for his match. would go out and have his match. He would come back. He would play cards. But if there was anything, if somebody walked in that locker room that he didn't want in there, get out.
Yeah.
It could have been somebody that was supposed to be in there, a guy that was bringing in toilet paper or something, you know, just anything.
Yeah.
And he was, the thing that we identified pretty quickly was he was in such bad back pain.
Mm.
He was hurting so bad, Chris. We would see him try to get in a first class seat on the plane, and he couldn't sit normal. He would have to get sideways. I guess it was his sack.
Sure.
And you hated it because here's this giant, there's the biggest guy in the world, and you could just see the tears in his eyes from the chronic pain. And every morning was a 6 o'clock flight. He would try to, after the show, he would try to drink himself down where he could get some sleep a couple of hours, because if you wasn't on that 6 o'clock flight, your ticket was no good.
Right.
That was those non-refundable ones in those days. You missed that flight, you had to buy your own ticket to the town. So we were all on it every morning, 6 o'clock.
Just winding down here, talk a little about Bobby Heenan. He gave you credibility right when you came in. Still, in my opinion, maybe the greatest manager ever.
Yeah.
Definitely one of the greatest commentators ever. Funny guy. Like, just a total blast to be around. At least when I hung out with him.
Oh, yeah.
Same for you guys.
The funniest, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Nonstop.
Yeah.
Nonstop.
If he was sitting here and you looked at him and you went, Bobby, shoes untied. Boom, he would hit you with a funny comeback. I mean, just that quick.
Yeah.
No setup, no thought process, nothing. No matter what you said to him, he had, and he was just hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was like light years as far as being so quick with a rebuttal. Mm-hmm. No matter what you said to him, he had something good. And, you know, one of the things that I don't think Bobby got enough credit for, when it was time, he would pop up on that apron. A babyface would run him down the apron, and he would eat that cross piece with his chest, wham, and take the god-awfulest bump you ever saw, and as good as anybody in the match.
Yeah.
And when it was the right time, boom, and that hair would be flying and shaking, and it looked like you'd killed the guy.
Yeah.
And it added so much to the match.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Bobby was, I was fortunate because he was managing Nick Bockwinkel with the AWA.
Yeah.
And my dad would bring Bockwinkel down and Bobby down. Well, they'd stay at my house. And so I'd get the all night version of that. And, you know, when he'd come down for two or three shots, and this was before I even went to North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And he was great to be around in the business, in the dressing room, outside.
Mm-hmm.
He's the same way all the time.
Right.
And, so it was great when they put him with us, and it did give us the credibility that instantaneously
But you guys were in the WWE just for a short period of time, and that was basically the end of Tully and Arn as a team.
Yeah.
Yes.
After that point in time,
mm-hmm.
Not to get into specifics, but why did you guys not decide to continue on?
Well, it's all my fault because. The situation was that Crockett had sold his company to Turner, and Turner was given big contracts away.
Right.
And they had promised a big contract to me and Arn if we'd leave the WWF. And so we gave our notices and worked out a finish date. And I flunked a piss test. And so with like 25 days left, I don't have a job. So I don't get sent to drug rehab, but I'm gone. And in 22 days, we're going to sign our contract with WCW. And then they called up on November 13th. Flair called me at 1 o'clock in the morning, told me they reneged on the deal. And so I am now unemployed. And the most tragic thing about that is that it affected him. In a massive
way. Your partner, right.
Yeah. And that's my biggest today regret. Not that I lost a job, but it affected him.
Mm.
And then I was sitting at home and I said, how in the world can I be out of the wrestling business?
That quick, right?
Yeah. You know, but in all of that,
when Flair called me at 1 o'clock, at 4 o'clock in the morning, I said, Jesus, take over my life. And that's what changed my heart and changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly didn't know that because I wasn't raised that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent the next year learning how to be sober and not be in the wrestling business, still wondering why I'm not in the wrestling mm-hmm. business. This makes no sense, me not being in the wrestling business, because I'm the only guy that ever flunked a drug test that got extricated and never came back. And
was that because of a TBS thing? Now that Turner owned it, they didn't want, because you had a drug conviction or got busted or whatever?
Don't know.
Right.
They, you know, Arn would answer that better.
Well, the biggest reason was there was an asshole named Jim Herd at the helm, and he figured out some way, somehow, when I came in for my meeting, that we weren't, that I wasn't worth as much to the company. They had made a deal for he and I. And you're not worth as much as you two guys were together, so we're going to cut your contract by $150,000 over a 3-year period.
Wow, yeah.
That time, that was a lot of money at my house. And then, you know, he saw I was not happy, as you could imagine, and he went, or aren't, hey, you know, no big deal. You go back to Vince if you want, no hard feelings. That's how little he knew about our business. What, I'm going to walk back in the door with my tail between my legs, stick my head in a window fan in Vince's office, and say, if there's anything left, go ahead and bury it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was stuck with that. And it's just one of those, it's one of those things in the business. It always doesn't go well. I could have pitched a bitch, sued them, whatever the deal was. But the reality is sometimes you have to look, and I went, okay, say that spends me a little money to have to sue them. What if I don't win? This is still more money than I'm qualified to make anywhere out in the free world. So I'll bite my lip. They were only working 6 or 7 days a month, and I'll just go with it. And
just
I went with
that,
it, just toughed it out. And it was, as you know, there's a roller coaster ride. If you stay in this business a couple of decades, much less, you know, this will be my 38th year.
It's unbelievable.
You know, I figured out pretty quickly, as long as you stay employed and make pretty good money, you don't have to make that top money for a couple, 3 years like a lot of guys, and then disappear. You'll still do okay.
That's right. You was know? It cool for you guys to reconcile over the years, and especially to be here, like we said, back in AW working together?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's although he did come down and goes to the ring with Cody every night, which is a little perplexing, but we'll cross that bridge.
It's the sweater vest. I'm just digging the sweater vest.
And the Waffle House menu. When I said that on commentary, I got 18,000 ha-has about your Waffle House menu.
And the rib is, you don't know how many times I've stared into that Waffle House menu.
I used to travel with you, man.
Pork chops. Chris, you want pork chops? No, I'm good.
Scrambled.
Scattered and smothered.
Last question for you guys. What's your favorite match that you had as a team, or does a couple of them stand out for you?
In a weird, sick way, to me, the first War Games, even though we got slaughtered.
Oh, God.
And we really did. The concept was so interesting, and that feeding – every few minutes feeding a fresh baby face in and being able to feed them however many guys were in the ring at the time and to get bounced around that cage and bleeding to death. For us blood and guts guys, you're one of those guys, it's a different level. When you're in a cage and you're getting run into that cage and you come up bleeding, it's a sick thing, but don't get any better than that.
There's no more in the moment feeling it as a wrestler when you have that blood coming down.
It's what we signed up for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes it real. It is real.
Yeah. And that one was in Atlanta.
And it's real blood.
Yeah. It really is, guys. How about you tell it? Does one stand up for you?
In a way, I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, in the War Games, Arn had to go against Dusty the first 5-minute period. And then it was, we got to go in next, so I'd go in next, and and then the babyface would catch back up and make the comebacks and like that. That was a unique floor plan for a match. And it was, before the match even started, was 25 minutes of blood and guts and comebacks and stuff. And so it was a magnificent match. And after the very first one in Atlanta, Crockett said, "God, that was great. Let's do that in Miami in another, in a month."
And Jacksonville and Cincinnati and all these
other smelled money.
But I've that's only the got thing. So much blood, Jim.
That's the thing, though. It's very rare that you do something for the first time. You guys were in the, like, we were about to have Blood and Guts in AEW 2 weeks before the pandemic made us all shut down. But I can go watch your War Games matches to see how you guys did it. But when it was the first one, there's nothing to compare it to.
Right.
Yeah, and you're getting to feel it, not knowing if it's going to work. Mm-hmm. But as you know, there's nothing like feeling something live.
Yeah.
The greatest feeling in this world was we all have our maestro stick. Some nights you go out and you wave it around and nobody cares. Nobody gives a shit.
Yeah.
And some nights, man, they just dip in and just fall in place and you just lead them anywhere you want. And with that thing, you do, when that cage door came open, it was almost like a horse race. Mm-hmm. You know, when the gate flies up, bring, and yeah. You know that, and you get four of those a night.
Yeah.
And then those, once everybody's in, the announcement, the match beyond begins, and now you have a 10-way. Mm-hmm. Right away, there's a 10-way and a finish. Mm-hmm. No delays. You don't take them back down. It just built and built and built, and it's just perfect for baby faces.
Yeah. Well, guys, it's great talking to you. Like I said, the greatest pure tag team ever. Great to have you here in AEW. I'm excited to continue to work with you guys and learn from you for sure.
Yeah.
And well, Chris, thank you for having us.
Yeah, we appreciate it.